Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. As today, we talk about the management and the use of hormonal therapy in the management of prostate cancer. We have a great faculty today, two investigators from Paris, Professor Karim Fezazi from the University of Paris-Saclay, and Dr. Stéphane Oudarche from the Hospital European Georges Pompidou, both in France, neighbors there. Dr. Smith did the first webinar in this series, and we're really pleased to have our colleagues from Paris and France here today for the second one. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by our faculty, just type them into the chat room, and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. We put out a real quick one-minute pre-meeting and post-meeting survey. If you could take that, you'll get a lot more out of the meeting, and we'll help us understand you and your needs. We know a lot of people end up listening to these webinars, and if you're into audio programs, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Srinivas on prostate cancer. We do webinars all the time. Next week, we'll be doing a program with Dr. Richardson from Dana-Farber on multiple myeloma, and then another program with Dr. Pollier on AML. Of course, Dr. Pollier has been so involved with the use of HMA venetoclax. That should be a really interesting meeting. Then we're heading out to the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium Wednesday of December 7th. We'll do a program on HER2 disease. Thursday the 8th, we'll do one on ER positive. And then the next day, we're skipping over to New Orleans, and we're doing three symposia at the ASH meeting, one on CLL, lymphomas, and myeloma. If you're not going to these meetings, these are all going to be online, so check it out. It should be a lot of fun. But today we're here to talk about prostate cancer, particularly hormonal therapy. And as always, we have a bunch of cases. We actually have 10 cases lined up. I don't know if we'll get through all of them. We got a bunch of great cases. We're going to make rounds with our colleagues here today. We're going to start out talking about a couple of papers, a journal club kind of feature. Then we'll dive into the cases. And if we have time in the last module, we'll talk about some new data that's come out and maybe new trials, et cetera. But just to kind of start out, so Karim, of course, the issue of PSMA targeting, both diagnostically and therapeutically, is really out on the table now. This is a great article reviewing that. There's some terrific graphics about that. Maybe you can just sort of summarize a little bit about some of the main points you get into with this paper, Karim.
Sure. Thank you, Neil. So basically, PSMA is a very appealing target for treatment in this disease in prostate cancer. And this is because it's a transmembrane protein that is overexpressed in most cancers, and especially in advanced prostate cancer that had already exhausted different treatments. So we know that for a quite long time, but until recently, we were not really able to target PSMA as a potential target for treatments. And it's now a reality with PSMA ligand lutetium, because this is a ligand that binds to the protein, and it's combined with lutetium that irradiate cancer cells. We now have level one evidence that overall survival is improved in men who have exhausted basically all what we had until now. And this is, as you know, Neil, approved by the FDA and getting the label more and more in the US. But there might be some other means that targeting PSMA, for example, CAR T, of course, are very appealing, even if complex and expensive. And the preliminary data that we have support indeed efficacy. This is also true with bispecifics, which are perhaps easier to make, but also associated with significant toxicity, including the cytokine release syndrome. And hopefully we may have also other drugs. It would be great to have ADCs, for example, targeting PSMA. So more and more is coming. Stay tuned. But I think it's a great story that's just starting now.
Stéphane, any comments? You know, just this week in the United States, we had teclistamab, the bispecific antibody to BCMA and myeloma that was approved first time, by so much excitement about that. Any thoughts about where this might head? Have actual responses been seen to, for example, CAR T targeting PSMA, Stéphane?
Yeah. Well, I think that CAR T cells, you know, drug are really interesting in prostate cancer as well as in hematological tumors as well. Of course, you know, the problem with CAR T cell is tolerability and toxicity. As you know, you can have a release cytokine syndrome, which is not so easy sometimes to take into to prevent and to treat for our patient. And as you know, patients having prostate cancer are elderly patient population, so with sometimes comorbidity, so we need to pay attention to those patients in order not to have any days related to the specific treatment. So, but it's really interesting to look at that, and I think that in the near future, we will have, you know, drugs which will be this kind of treatment and will be given to prostate cancer patients. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the other thing about bispecifics, Kareem, is they're talking about the possibility of community-based oncologists administering this in the future after, you know, because it seems like they don't really see that much CRS. Any other thoughts about imaging based on PSMA? Of course, that's going to be a major issue when we get into the cases. But anything you want to say in general about percent of PSMA positivity and false negative and false positive PSMA scanning, Kareem?
So if we're speaking about very advanced disease, metastatic castration-resistant disease, I would say that approximately 90% of patients have cancers that express the PSMA protein, so 90. So that's by far the majority. One issue, though, is that there might be some discrepancies between lesions, especially in rare patients with liver metastasis, who more rarely express PSMA. So you might see PSMA expressing, say, nodal disease versus non-PSMA expressing liver disease. And of course, patients are not going to die from their lymph node, but actually from their liver disease. So that's also something to take into consideration. Now, you're very right, Neil. In earlier stages, we need to be cautious because a false positive exists. And of course, we need to avoid, you know, making inadequate treatment decision based on that. So we need, as with any imaging technique, we have to learn how to best use it.
So Stefan, Anita in the chat room says, when do you use PSMA PET versus Oxymin PET?
Well, PSMA PET, you know, I think that the best way to use it in a rising PSA status, you know, to see really, you know, the stage of the disease, and also for patients having localized disease, you know, high risk localized disease, to see if we don't have already a metastatic disease for those patients. So I think that the two main stage where you need to go for this kind of new imaging.
So, Kareem, any preference in situations where you rather do PSMA or rather do Oxium?
Yeah, we don't really use fluciclovine here in Europe. We use either choline, or which is probably similar, to be honest, or let's say in the same range, or PSMA. There is clear data, I think, that PSMA is better, generally speaking, even though the two or three different imaging do not necessarily see exactly the same thing. But if I have to choose, I would go for PSMA in most cases, I have to say.
So, Stefan, I know you're involved with these cyclone studies. I never even heard about that until we had our first program with Dr. Smith. Abemaciclib in prostate cancer. We talk about abemaciclib all the time in breast cancer. There's a reason, of course, there are three CDK inhibitors used in breast cancer. Abemaciclib, though, is the only one that actually has single agent activity and also good data in the adjuvant setting. Is the thinking, I see here, this one study here is just using Abema alone, the Cyclone 1, and then Cyclone 2, kind of similar to what happened with breast cancer combining with hormone therapy. Any thoughts about where this might be heading, Stefan? Is this kind of the same principle as in breast cancer?
Yes, I think we had, you know, very interesting data from in breast cancer from the MONARCH, you know, study. It was a phase 3 trial looking at the efficacy of CD4-6 inhibitor with fulvestrant in metastatic hormone-sensitive breast cancer. The study was positive in terms of OS, you know, data. So that's why we wanted to see in prostate cancer if we can reverse the resistance induced by ADT for prolonged ADT treatment for those patients. So that's why we have the Cyclone 1 and Cyclone 2 study. So Cyclone 1 study was looking at this drug in monotherapy, and it gave, you know, some efficacy. But I think the most interesting thing is to combine this drug with new hormonal therapy such as abiraterone, and this phase 2-3 trial will give an answer regarding whether or not we can prolong, you know, the duration of efficacy of abiraterone acetate in this setting.
So
we need also to pay attention to toxicity and especially diarrhea, which sometimes is difficult to handle. Yeah.
So yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how that rolls out. Here's the Cyclone 2 study. So here we're going to jump into the cases. Most of these are hormone-sensitive metastatic disease where we get the most questions. But we're going to start out with a case of a biochemical recurrence. This is a 59-year-old man who status post-prostatectomy, then had post-op radiation therapy, 6 months of hormonal therapy. Maybe later on we'll talk about the paper we have from ESMO, kind of getting into the issue of RT in this situation. Anyhow, develops a PSA recurrence a couple years later. A PSA was pretty low, 0.5, doubling time 9 months. Here's Dr. Brooks.
In this particular patient, he has a rising PSA. It's a very low level, but his doubling time is less than 9 months. He's a very bright guy. He actually recently divorced and in a new relationship. He's concerned about hormonal treatment, but he also wants to live as long as he can. I did try to get an ex-human PET CT, and despite a peer-to-peer review on that, they did not allow it. And I guess I would be interested in knowing how your experts are going to be using, whether it be ex-human or PSMA PET, how they compare them. So he's in the situation, Neil, where I don't think we really know when is the right time to start hormonal therapy, and is it going to change survival? He is eligible for this trial comparing an LHR inhibitor alone, which would probably be standard, versus that plus apalutamide versus the third arm of that apalutamide and abiraterone.
So I guess that trial kind of reflects increasing interest in moving endocrine or hormonal therapy up earlier. So Kareem, just to start with the basics of when do you treat a patient like this? You know, that's been discussed for so long. You know, doubling time, from what I've been hearing over the years, is something that's certainly a primary consideration, particularly 6 months. But it's interesting, here's a man who's just getting married, and you know, maybe delaying for a year or two might be really important to him. How would you, and on the other hand, he's a young person who doesn't want to compromise long-term survival. Any thoughts about whether, when or if to start therapy in this situation, Kareem?
So I think first that this gentleman has probably exhausted already all options for local treatments. So local therapy to the prostate or to the prostate bed is not anymore an option. That's, you know, something we should start with. Second, indeed, PSA doubling time is a strong predictor of outcome in this setting. So we need to be very careful about how to best calculate it when we're dealing with very low values. It's always better to have more values. And I know it's an issue because then it's maybe too late or you waste some time. So but there is no magic solution. But just you know, for colleagues to remember that we need to be cautious also, because we may make mistakes calculating with very low values. Third, this is typically really where next generation imaging can be helpful. We don't have level one evidence for metastasis directed therapy, but it's quite likely, actually, that this can help some of these men, and randomized phase 3 trials are currently ongoing. So especially in a gentleman who is a bit anxious about receiving ADT, I would do my best to do, for example, a PSMA PET, which would be ideal. And with a PSA of 0.5, there is at least a half a chance that the PSMA PET will tell us where the disease or part of the disease is located. Then Philip was very right. We just don't know now whether we should use, in these patients with quite poor risk disease, ADT alone, or should we intensify treatment with, for example, apalutamide or darolutamide or abiraterone or enzalutamide. Trials are maturing rapidly. We should actually see some data, hopefully next year. We have STAMPE data, small data, but supporting that abiraterone may help also these men. Last point, pay attention to the Gleason score. If this is Gleason 8, 9, or 10, be very careful. And to me, this is another reason to treat the patient quite early and not wait too long.
So, Stefan, I'm kind of curious, in a patient like this, if he were able to get a PSMA scan and, you know, one site of metastatic disease or was thought to be metastatic disease, would you consider local therapy? Would you require a biopsy first?
Well, if we have a rising PSA, and as Karim said, you know, we have three rise in PSA showing that, you know, there is a recurrent disease. I think it won't be easy to make biopsy because it's always, you know, difficult for those patients, especially if you have bone metastasis. It's different if you have a lymph node metastasis. I won't go for sure for a biopsy, but I will try to make a targeted treatment towards this oligometastasis, you know, maybe to, as Karim said, to delay systemic treatment. It's a young guy, maybe wants to keep on to have an active sexuality. So if we can, you know, maintain quality of life and delay the arrival of treatment with hormonal therapy, I would go for a stereotaxic treatment on the metastasis.
So, Karim, actually, Dr. Kumar in the chat room, he's in our chat room a lot, always brings up great points, says that he has a patient on intermittent LHRH for the last 10 years. He actually said he had to start it because of lack of insurance, and then he just kept doing it. So he wants to know, how do you decide when to use intermittent treatment?
Well, when I use salvage ADT for men with biochemical failures, I tend to use it intermittently indeed, not continuously. And we actually have a very large randomized phase 3 trial from Canada indicating that indeed we should use intermittent ADT and not continuous ADT with similar efficacy and lower toxicity. So I would do as he does. And actually, I was about to mention to Philip that to convince this gentleman to start treatment, you can, you know, I often have this discussion with my patient. Okay, I'm telling them, you know what, let's get started. You do one injection. Probably you won't suffer from side effects, but if ever this is the case, we will just stop and you will recover. Especially such a young man, you know, 59 years. Even, you know, from a sexual standpoint, it shouldn't be terrible. And if a patient is not happy with the treatment, then we stop and we try to find other options. And I think it's a good way to have more patients being treated. On the other hand, many patients on intermittent therapy do not complain a lot about side effects, I have to say. It's mostly hot flashes. But the rest is usually quite well accepted, at least my experience.
That's a really interesting, very practical approach to this. I'm curious, Stefan, you know, of course, the whole side effects with ADT are problematic and difficult to get around. But I'm also curious about the metabolic effects on patients, increasing risk for coronary artery disease, and what you do with your patients who go on ADT to try to, you know, avoid cardiovascular complications.
Mm-hmm. Well, we always, you know, refer our patient to the cardiologist and also to the endocrinologist to check for cardiac, you know, status and so on, in order to follow this metabolic syndrome, which is usually which do not give symptoms in daily practice. So you need to really to be proactive in order to prevent the appearance of hypercholesterolemia, hypertriglyceridemia, and so on, leading to cardiovascular problems. So we try now to be really proactive in terms of supportive care. And by the way, we can limit and lower side effects and complications.
So we are going to spend most of our time talking about metastatic disease, but I do want to ask you about castrate-resistant M0 disease, which sometimes we see. And, of course, we have data now for 3 anti-androgens to use in this situation. I'm kind of curious. I don't know whether you have access to all 3, Kareem, but assuming you did, how would you choose between the 3?
Well, I guess the efficacy is not really an issue. All 3 drugs, darolutamide, enzalutamide, apalutamide, are clearly very active in the setting of M0 CRPC. And it's very rare that a patient is refractory to one of those. Of course, it's always difficult to make indirect comparisons. And I mean, we don't have phase 3 comparison between these 3 agents. But again, indirect comparisons support very similar efficacy. So it's much more about safety and maybe also drug-drug interactions issues. Regarding safety, when comparing each drug versus its own placebo, you do see apparent differences. For example, enzalutamide and apalutamide are often associated with significant fatigue, and it's mostly intellectual fatigue due to cognitive impairment because these drugs go to the brain. Also, and probably for the same reasons, in the trials there was an excess in falls and fractures with these 2 drugs. Apalutamide also has the issue of rashes, of hypothyroidism, and we don't actually really see these side effects with darolutamide. The same applies to drug-drug interaction. Unfortunately, enzalutamide and apalutamide do impact on several SIPs, so you need to be cautious. And most of all, our patients do have many comorbidities, and for these reasons are on many drugs. And it's always very difficult to figure out where the interaction is. Darolutamide is probably also favored in this comparison. So I do have, and same to Stefan, we do have access in France to the 3 drugs. I tend to mostly use darolutamide for all these reasons, but again, not really for efficacy reasons. They're very similar.
And of course, we've been hearing that when we had our first program with Dr. Matt Smith, and he made similar comments. Stefan, I'm curious what your vision is of what, you know, what's going on with people on enzalutamide, any of these anti-androgens potentially, but particularly enzalutamide and apalutamide, when they have the, quote, fatigue. You know, it's thought to be a CNS. How does it play out in your practice? What do you see in these patients? Also, are there any supportive care strategies that you recommend to try to overcome the fatigue?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't use too much, you know, enzalutamide because, you know, this drug induced, as Karim said, you know, neurological problem, dizziness, you know, mental, you know, problem, falls and so on. So I would prefer to use either darolutamide or apalutamide. And as Karim said, you know, apalutamide could give a cutaneous reaction, a rash and so on. So really, We don't have any face-to-face, you know, study. We can only compare placebo versus the experimental drug from Spartan, Prosper, and Aramis. But I think in daily practice, we, as Karim said, you know, darolutamide don't go through the brain and maybe prevent, you know, a neurological problem. And in terms of drug-drug interaction, this is the easiest drug to use because, as you know, those patients have comorbidity on a lot of drugs to take in daily practice. So you may avoid by this way any drug-drug interaction. So if the patient have any neurological problem, either I decrease the dose of the drug, or I move from APA or from ONSA to another drug, and especially darolutamide.
So Kareem, I wanted to ask you about this recently published paper looking at the Aramis trial that we've been talking about, because there's an interesting finding in here. You know, one of the things about all these trials is the entry criteria was doubling time of 10 months or less. And I think a lot of people looked at those trials and thought, that's great, but what about people who have 12, 14, 15 months? Are they going to benefit? And I don't know if we have or even going to get data. But I thought this analysis was very interesting, maybe providing some clues about this, looking at the benefit based on PSA doubling time. Can you comment on what you saw there?
Sure. PSA doubling time indeed is a strong predictor of outcomes in the setting of CRPCM0. In the trials, we had to use a cutoff for practical reasons to enrich in the population of patients enrolled with men most likely to die from the disease and to develop metastasis. So this is why we use PSA doubling time of less than 10 months as a cutoff. But honestly, it could have been 9 months or 11 months, of course, or even six, probably. So it was also a balance between feasibility of a trial, a number of events, you know, all these things. So this analysis clearly shows, as you can see on the screen, that patients with a very rapid PSA doubling time, so less than 6 months, clearly benefit from here darolutamide, as you might expect from the overall analysis of a trial. But also, most importantly, perhaps, the population of men with a PSA doubling time somewhere between 6 to 10 months also seem to benefit pretty much the same. The hazard ratio are very stable, so very robust and similar data. So I agree with you, Neil. It makes me wonder whether this data also applies or not to men with PSA doubling time of, say, 10 to 15 months, which is something we don't know because we don't have the evidence for that. But, you know, this is puzzling. And when I'm seeing a patient in this situation, I really wonder whether we should treat also and intensify these men.
Or you need to bring it up to the patient as a possibility. Stefan, I'm curious about your thoughts about it. When I saw this, I know I always think about other cancers, so excuse me. I know breast cancer is different, but, you know, we think about it. But it kind of reminded me of what you see in the adjuvant trials of breast cancer. As you were saying, a lot of the trials establish the benefit of tamoxifen and everything else, node-positive patients. But then they started to see the hazard rate was the same, just like you see here. And then they extrapolated down and said, well, we assume it's going to have the same hazard rate. Maybe the absolute benefit won't be as great. I don't know if that paradigm will end up happening in prostate cancer. It does seem like I keep seeing earlier and earlier. Stefan, any thoughts?
Yes, of course, you know, we always, you know, try to use a drug and at a late stage of the disease and then moving to early stage, you know, based on the fact that the drug is active, you know, so that's the way to perform research and clinical trials. So, and as you can see with hormonal therapy, we move from a metastatic stage to now raising PSA stage and now locally advanced disease, you know, so especially for a very aggressive localized prostate cancer disease as well. So, yeah, this is a way to perform research and clinical trial.
So here's our first hormone-sensitive metastatic case. We could probably spend 3 hours just on this case, but we'll try to get to the nitty-gritty of it because I kind of wonder whether people really are getting the right message here, and I hope we can clarify it, particularly as it relates to a kind of interesting editorial that just came out in the JCO. But let's go back to cases. This is a patient who's 70 years old, has a pacemaker status post cerebral vascular accident. Our faculty was telling me in Paris it's what, AVC, you switched it. But anyhow, so stroke and a pacemaker, de novo metastatic disease. Here's Dr. Shahada's questions.
This is a 70-year-old. He has some comorbidities, maybe a little bit of heart disease, has a pacemaker, but functional. My question to the expert here, I'm sure you're familiar with the new drug, Relugolix, which is done in a HERO trial. I didn't see a huge pickup in the community using this oral agent. I have used it a few times, and I think it has a lot of advantage. You know, it can decrease the testosterone pretty fast. You don't have to worry about a flare-up reaction. So how do you use this drug? What are the patients that you think this drug has advantage over LHRH antagonist or even agonist? You know, we know that the HERO trial showed that it has significant less cardiac morbidity down the road when you use these drugs. The other question that I like to ask about sequencing and combining AR signaling inhibitors, according to recent data from PEACE-1 trial, adding chemotherapy to abiraterone. Are you moving in that direction? I'm thinking about using chemotherapy in addition to AR signaling inhibitor in this particular patient because he has a lot of disease in his abdomen and pelvis. He has huge lymph nodes there and mass. As you can tell, huge masses in the pelvis causing his hydronephrosis and DVT as well.
So we're kind of going to take this one piece at a time. Let's start out with we'll bring in some of the other cases to address the more global issue that he's bringing up about choice of therapy. But Stefan, what about Relugolix? You know, it got a lot of attention last year when it was presented at ASCO. We saw some updated data at AUA. Looks like same thing, you know, significantly fewer cardiovascular events. This man doesn't have a strong history, maybe a little bit of a history. You'll have the issue of, in the United States anyhow, the copay, financial issues, but also the convenience of oral treatment. Any thoughts about this strategy, Stefan?
I think it's a good strategy. Problem, you know, is quite old so far. And, you know, if you give this drug, which is an hourly drug, which can have less cardiac, you know, problem, which can, you know, decrease the level of testosterone quite quickly, and you can may have also recovery after, if you stop the treatment as well. I think it's a good antagonist of LHRH, you know, maybe great, I don't know, but than Degarelix. There is no face-to-face study between Degarelix and this drug, but I would choose this antagonist treatment in order to avoid a cardiac problem for this patient.
So I'm just kind of curious, Kareem, in general, from what you've seen and what you see on these scans and what you heard about this case, putting aside, you know, reimbursement issues, putting aside trials, outside of a trial, what would you be thinking about for this patient, Kareem?
So regarding the question about LHRH antagonist, I also support what was said by Stefan and by all the colleagues. The data, what's nice in the Relugolix story is that basically it's a confirmation. We already saw data suggesting strongly that the risk of cardiovascular toxicity is lower with LHRH antagonist as compared to LHRH agonist. So in a patient's at risk, that would be my preferred choice if I can. Now, of course, you may debate between injections and oral, and that's also a question of convenience to patient and maybe cost, all these things. Now, besides the castration, the question is really, should we intensify therapy? And should we consider chemotherapy? Should we consider a second generation AR axis inhibitor? Should we consider both? I'm not sure I have, you know, I've seen everything for this gentleman to help me make my decision. I don't really know whether he has bone disease, and if so, whether it's extensive bone disease or not, visceral disease, I don't really know. I see very large lymph nodes here. But let's assume that indeed he has, I don't know, 10 bone mets on top of what we see on the bone scan. Yes, indeed, this would be good reason for me, ideally, to intensify treatment with probably both docetaxel and an AR axis drug. question is whether the patient will be able to tolerate it, especially with in a situation when he had a CVA, I think, 6 months ago. Of course, we need to be extremely cautious there and have discussion with the neurologist, the cardiologist, the patient himself, and try to make the best decision. Because what we may win against the prostate cancer, of course, we may lose it on the safety side. So those situations are clearly touchy, and I'm always on the fence when I'm dealing with patients at risk for cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm.
So, Stefan, before these trials came out with triplets, and I remember when the pandemic hit, at that point, people were choosing, at that point in time, in terms of prostate cancer, between docetaxel or secondary hormonal therapy. And it always seemed a little weird not to have the hormonal therapy on board. And in retrospect, I wonder whether those two were equivalent options. But with all the data coming in with triplets, one of the issues is, do we have data? Now, clinical decision-making, that's a different story. But do we have data to support that you get a benefit if you add docetaxel on top of ADT plus secondary hormonal therapy? This editorial just came out in the Journal of Clinical Oncology and addressing this issue. They point out, which seemed like it was the case, that the trials, the piece one that everybody talks about, et cetera, was docetaxel plus or minus hormones, not hormones plus or minus docetaxel. So they concluded that triplet therapy, quote, may be a viable option for men with hormone-sensitive metastatic disease who would have just gotten ADT and docetaxel. And we have a couple of patients like that who did get that. Then the paper says the benefits of triplet therapy over ADT plus ASI remain questionable. Like I said, I don't think there's data on that because of a lack of head-to-head comparison. And they conclude by saying in the absence of definitive evidence of benefit, particularly in men with lower grade disease, lower volume disease, the default should be simpler, less toxic treatment. When I brought this paper up to the two of you when we were just chatting to get started, I found your thoughts about it very interesting because I figured everybody was going to agree with it, but you two don't agree with it at all. So, Stefan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, if you go back, you know, to this patient, you know, as Karim said, you know, we don't have, you know, the volume of the disease, you know, in order to choose really what to do for this patient. We don't have as well the risk of the disease, you know, so it's difficult at the end to answer, but we know that this patient has some comorbidity. So I would say that now for de novo metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer patient, we should not go anymore with ADT plus docetaxel alone, I would say, combo of ADT plus docetaxel. We should go either to ADT plus hormonal therapy or ADT plus hormonal therapy plus docetaxel based on the PIECE1, you know, study. And as you know, in the PIECE1 study, for de novo metastatic patient, you know, the PFS is in favor of the triplet versus the doublet. And for high volume disease, you know, it has been shown nicely by Karim that really you increase, you know, the outcome of the disease by performing triplet versus doublet. So now, as you know, Karim said, you know, I think you should go and to see if the patient if the treatment is manageable for the patient. If you perform the triplet and with docetaxel you have some side effect and the patient is maybe have some toxicity while you stop docetaxel and you only go for the doublet later on. So I think that you need to modulate, you know, your treatment according to the patient tolerability of the triplet, you know. So, yeah.
So, Karim, I'm curious about your thoughts. You know, we have randomized data, and we also have the art of oncology. You know, you're looking at a younger patient with, you know, severe, you know, visceral mets, et cetera. You know, kind of you can understand the thinking of, you know, adding in docetaxel. But I think it's different when you do that, when you have randomized data and you don't. And I think everybody sort of thinks that PIECE1 was not really what PIECE1 was, which was, you know, adding hormones onto docetaxel rather than the reverse. So any thoughts, Karim?
Well, yes, I agree with you, Neil. And basically, we have strong data indicating that second generation AR targeting and taxane do not work the same way and can circumvent resistance one to the other in men with metastatic disease. And there are multiple, basically, phase three trials in mCRPC to support what I'm saying. So basically, we're not targeting the cancer the same way with those two families of agents. And this is why it makes, besides the PIS1 and the ARASENS data, this is why it makes so sense to me to combine these agents, understanding that the safety is not really an issue with the combination, basically because, you're targeting the cancer two different ways and perhaps actually not the same clones. And at the end of the day, what the trials show is that there's benefit to patients. Of course, the current trials do not answer all questions, but this is always the case. And I really think that given all this, the DOP should just benefit to the patient. And if this is a de novo patient with metastatic disease and is fit enough and willing to get for chemotherapy, it should really be proposed a triplet treatment. We now have two and actually even three randomized trials indicating that overall survival is indeed improved when we do so as compared to a doublet.
So I think, I know I was all excited when I saw the ARASENS data because we'd already been hearing about the advantage in terms of tolerability. I'm like, okay, great. Now we have data in the metastatic hormone sensitive, but then it was with docetaxel. So like, where's the single arm? And that wasn't in there. I know there's another trial looking at that. But again, this was docetaxel plus or minus darolutamide. Anything you want to say about the more recent data, Kareem, that was presented by Dr. Saad from the ARASENS study at ASCO looking at responsive PSA?
Sure. Actually, I think this is more interesting for designing the next generation of trials. And let me explain that. Basically, what Fred reported is that experiencing as a patient an undetectable PSA by 6 to 8 months after the start of systemic therapy is a good thing because these men do extremely well. While on the other hand, patients with a detectable PSA by this time just don't do well, even if they have not progressed yet, or their cancer has not progressed yet. So I think this is, and what Fred also showed is that indeed darolutamide is able to achieve this endpoint much more frequently than what was reported in the control arm, which clearly shows the efficacy of darolutamide. But again, for the future, I think designing a new generation of trial based on this data will be extremely exciting. For men with undetectable PSA, we may actually start, probably for the first time in this disease, doing de-escalation. We may not need to treat these patients forever, and this can be of high benefit from a safety standpoint, for a financial standpoint, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, for men with a detectable PSA, we may not, just wait for the progression to occur to intervene. And perhaps this is a very good opportunity to intensify the treatment even further before the cancer becomes really, really hard to treat. So you can imagine two new generation of phase three trial that should be able to explore these questions. And I'm very excited about that.
So I want to spend most of the rest of the time going through these cases, but I'm just going to flip through this paper in the slide set designed for patients that I think is really cool to try to come up. I know you were involved with actually doing this, Kareem, but I think this is awesome. I've seen a bunch of trials and therapies done by this journal. It's really great. I'd love to work with them, actually. Just a couple of quick questions from the chat room from Swati. Stefan, is ARASENS the new standard of care for hormone-sensitive metastatic disease? And then Kamal wants to know, do you consider mutations like P10 and T53 when deciding whether to use docetaxel?
Well, looking at the ASCENT, you know, study, it's a great, you know, study, and the study is positive for overall survival, you know, with the triplet using darolutamide. You know, as we know, there is no increased toxicity with the addition of darolutamide to docetaxel. So this is good news. In this study, we didn't have, you know, information regarding the volume of the risk of the disease as we had, you know, for the PIS1 study. So maybe it's more difficult to see which patient would benefit the most, you know, from this triplet. But nevertheless, we saw that, you know, it's the combination of ADT plus darolutamide plus docetaxel is greater than the comparator. So in France, we don't yet have the access to daro in hormone sensitive situation, but I think that in the near future it will be a good combination to use in this setting. Now about P10, P10 and what?
Yeah.
And what else?
TP53 and P10.
According to chemotherapy or to hormonal therapy treatment? Yeah. Well, I think it's too early, but maybe Karim can give an answer about that. I think it's too early to say that hormonal therapy or chemotherapy maybe works better according to this specific molecular modification of pathway. So I think it's too early to give an answer. So what is your thoughts, Karim?
Well, basically, I mean, I agree with you. Those are two adverse prognostic factors. It's not good to have P10 loss or P53 alterations in their disease. But right now, it doesn't necessarily impact on the treatment decision-making. Having said that, there is an ongoing phase 3 trial looking at AKT inhibition in with capivasertib in men with P10 loss. I think this will be very interesting to follow. Data are promising. I don't know the eventual readouts, but I think the concept is really interesting. So we should stay tuned about that.
So here's the phase 3 ARANET trial. We were talking about darolutamide versus placebo. I'm trying to figure out who's going to want to go on the placebo arm. I think it'd be really cool to do darolutamide plus or minus docetaxel, but I don't know if that's ever going to happen. Anyhow, let's get back to the cases. This is a scenario I heard a bunch of. You know, if you think about what preceded the triplets, which was, again, docetaxel versus hormones, you got a bunch of patients out there who got ADT plus docetaxel. And to a lot of oncologists, that's a little problematic. Here's a good example of that. A young patient, 49 years old, does have multiple comorbidities, presents with de novo, which you two both were mentioning about the issue of de novo versus recurrent in terms of worse prognosis, PSA of 19.4, and he gets ADT docetaxel. Here's Dr. Carr.
This is a very young 49-year-old male who's actually a truck driver by profession, has a history of type 2 diabetes, hyperlipidemia, hypertension, obesity, and prior history of scoliosis. He was found to have extensive lymphadenopathy in his pelvis and retroperitoneal lymphadenopathy as well, along with the widespread bony metastasis disease. His PSA was 19.4. He decided to proceed with treatment with docetaxel along with the hormonal therapy, and all of his imaging, you know, lymphadenopathy findings pretty much resolved, and his follow-up bone scan was showing treated bone metastases, and his PSA number up until now continues to remain kind of in the undetectable range. So the question comes with the recent trial with the ARASENS, with the addition of darolutamide along with docetaxel and the hormonal therapy, do the expert think that will be a practice-changing recommendation moving forward?
So Stefan, the real question, one of the questions he was getting into is should you add darolutamide now? You know, if it were 6 months later, 12 months, at any point, would you try to do sort of delayed ARASENS?
Mm-hmm. You know, we spoke about, you know, the PSA response at 6 to 8 months below 0.2. And Karim said that, you know, if you have a very good response, kind of PSA undetectable, it's associated with a good outcome. So by using this endpoint, you could, you know, say, well, my treatment is good enough. I don't need to intensify the treatment. So maybe I could follow this patient. And that's fine, you know. So and it has been shown in the PEACE 1 study presented at the ESMO meeting. It has been shown with this TETON trial with apalutamide. So we have now a lot of, you know, different studies showing that a cutoff of 0.2 on undetectable PSA at 6 to 8 months is associated with a good outcome. So the question is whether we add toxicity based on the addition of darolutamide, metabolic syndrome, cardiac problem, and so on, or we wait for progression. This is an open question. And as Karim said, you know, we try better to decrease and de-intensify treatment at this stage in case of very good response, instead of increasing, putting one drug on the top of the other in order to have a greater effect. But in these clinical cases, we have already undetectable PSA.
That's a really great point. So, Karim, here's another variation of the hormone-sensitive, you know, in clinical practice, in reality situation. 65-year-old man, again, de novo metastatic disease, and maybe you can comment on how you approach de novo or how you think it through versus relapse, and gets started on a leuprolide and does great. And here's Dr. Messner-Sodersky's question about the case.
He's just on leuprolide, and the idea was to get him for PEACE 1 triple therapy. But his PSA dropped from 800 to 1. He has excellent response. I'm kind of stuck. He feels great. What to do?
So what are you thinking you want to do?
I would like to add abiraterone, but I wouldn't add chemotherapy since he has such a good response and he has a good quality of life. And his mass is almost down to nothing. The other question was, is there a role for consolidation radiation? Since the mass, it was a bulky disease, but right now it's gone and it's a metastatic disease.
So any advice and also any comments about treatment to the primary?
So first of all, you know, it seems that apparently at least having a PSA dropping from 800 plus down to 1 is a good thing, but actually it's not a good thing. As already alluded to by Stefan, a good thing would be a PSA lower than 0.2 or 0.1, especially if we're speaking about PSA value measured by 6 to 8 months after the start of leuprolide here, ADT. So actually, it's not a good news to have a PSA of 1, even if this gentleman started with a very high value. And that would have been another very good reason for me to consider intensification of this gentleman. I mean, apparently he's a 65-year-old man. I didn't hear many comorbidities. He had quite extensive disease, if I understood well. So yes, I think he could have been a very good candidate for systemic intensification upfront, again, immediately or as soon as possible. And one of the good things with both ARASENS, PEACE-1 and all these trials is that we combine concomitantly the Staxel and the AR drug. And perhaps part of the efficacy that we saw is related to the fact that indeed we use this treatment concomitantly. We didn't wait for the cancer to resist before attacking it. Now, regarding the question of radiation therapy directed to the primary, there is now level one evidence that indeed we should do that in men with a low volume of disease. And low volume of disease is basically defined as less than 3 bone metastases and no visceral metastases, just to make it easy. Now, this is because radiation therapy is associated with overall survival improvement for these men, not for men with more extensive disease. Having said that, what we don't really know is whether irradiating also men with more extensive disease can help controlling the local progression and the symptoms related to that, even without overall survival benefit. Hopefully, PEACE 1 will address this question. This is the second question that PEACE 1 has planned to answer. Hopefully, we will have the answer next year.
Great. Let's go on. I'm going to try to see if we can get in a couple more cases. So, Stefan, this is a 58-year-old man, again, hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, gets treated initially with ADT alone, leuprolide, has PSA progression, progression a year and a half later, responds to abiraterone prednisone, is doing well, but she sends a liquid biopsy and it comes back with an ART878 mutation. And the report says, don't give the patient abiraterone, except the patient's already responding to abiraterone. I was going to ask both of you about the whole issue of resistance to endocrine therapy, hormonal therapy of prostate cancer. Maybe this is a way to sort of get into it. Here's the case.
He had significant 100-pound weight loss in 6 months. The baseline PSA came back as greater than 5,000. Pan body CT showed a hardened appearing prostate and multiple liver lesions. We had a staging PET scan which showed bony mets and also had some lung lesions. He was treated with hormonal therapy and zoledronic acid. And his PSA actually had a dramatic response, gradually came down to 2. But a year and a half later or so, his PSA started rising up to the 200 range. At that point, we had switched him to abiraterone and prednisone. And he actually was doing pretty well. When we did the liquid biopsy testing on him, it showed a mutation ART878.
Any thoughts, Stefan?
Yeah, I think it's a resistance to abiraterone for sure. But I think it's too early, you know, to only on a liquid biopsy to say, well, I'm going to change my treatment because, you know, it's I think there is no rationale for that so far, you know. So we know that sooner or later the patient is going to resist and to progress on abiraterone. But I won't change so far right now the treatment.
So let me do another case. Hassan in the chat room wants to know about adding a PARP inhibitor to hormonal therapy. And of course, we have the PROPEL and MAGNITUDE studies out there, which interestingly were with abiraterone. I think there's a press release looking at that strategy with enzalutamide. I'm not sure. I think it hasn't been presented yet. Anyhow, this is a patient with a CHEK2 germline mutation presented with de novo metastatic disease. Again, ADT and docetaxel. I mean, it was only a couple of years ago that we were doing that. Now, with progression on abiraterone, prednisone, and is noted to have a germline mutation. Here's Dr. Zafar.
That's an interesting case. 65, high Gleason score. He had de novo metastatic disease with bone metastases in 2018, treated with docetaxel and ADT. And he had quite a good response. And then in 2021, had progression, radiographic and biochemical. And he was treated with Abipred, which he was on for about 2 years. And now he progressed. He has a CHEK2 mutation. And we started him on olaparib this year. And he has a PSA response. And also his pain is improving. He seems to have a radiographic response with some improvement in the disease burden. But is this a patient where we could use an AR antagonist in addition to olaparib? If I were to see this guy now, I mean, I would strongly think about the combination. But, you know, he's just started the PARP inhibitor this year. So would it be reasonable to add ENZA maybe or just let it be on olaparib?
So maybe we should go for a second hour of this webinar and just talk about this case. But Kareem, maybe you can just take a stab at it. You know, kind of, I guess this patient went through what would have been standard a couple of years ago, and now, particularly with these two trials. So my question is, any thoughts about this case? And ideally, would you add in enzalutamide now? If you backtrack to when he got the abiraterone, would you have given him the PARP inhibitor at that point? And then I'm going to say same exact case, except no check mutation, no nothing, because, I mean, the PROPEL trial showed benefit in HR proficient. So any thoughts, Kareem?
Right, yeah, complex questions, and the answers are just emerging. We just saw this year the two first trials combining AR targeting with PARP inhibitors with discrepancy between the two, Magnitude and Propel. We should see TALAPRO2 data very soon now. So it's hard. I mean, we're still on the fog somehow. You know, this gentleman has a CHK2 alteration, which seems to be a predictor for efficacy for PARP inhibitors, regardless of the AR discussion. Although the data are scarce, those alterations are much rarer as compared to BRCA2, for example. So it's very difficult to make sure. But similar to what our colleague did, I would have indeed give it a chance to olaparib or any PARP inhibitor. Now, whether intensifying treatment with and combining the PARP inhibitor with AR targeting will further improve that, I honestly don't know. And I think we just need more data to figure out. And that's even more difficult, Neil, if the patient has no CHK2 alteration. Again, we have two trials with this discrepancy. We just need a couple of more months and see what TALAPRO2 shows. And then I think we can start again the discussion, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, actually, in ovarian cancer, you have the reverse situation. They have data with niraparib and not with olaparib with HR proficient. So a complex topic, that issue of whether to treat a patient, you know, who doesn't have anything. We did a poll of investigators, and only one of them said they would do it, and that was the principal investigator of the PROPEL trial, Dr. Saad. So I think everybody else is kind of sitting back and waiting. Well, thank you so much, Stefan and Kareem. We could go on for a long time. Prostate cancer is such a fascinating disease, so much going on. And speaking of disease with a lot going on, coming back next Tuesday, we'll hear what Dr. Richardson has to say, particularly about bispecifics, teclistamab out there. When and how are you going to use it? Are you going to use it in clinical practice right now in general medical oncology practice? Is that coming? We'll find out next Tuesday. Be safe. Stay well. Audience, thank you so much for attending. Have a great night. Thanks so much, Stefan. Thank you, Kareem.
Thank you, Neil.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye, all.
Bye. Good night.